is certainly going to have a big impact on the community, as well as suspect and victim.
A former Ketchikan High School teacher and pastor is charged with sexual abuse of a student. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, June 12th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a new report looked at harassment toward fisheries observers.
A lot of times it is a person actually standing in front of the observer, preventing them from going where they need to go.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. Each semester, undergraduate students at UAA are learning through hands-on research experiences that take them outside the classroom. Working alongside faculty and professionals in the field, students have used their research to begin exciting careers, to secure patents for their inventions, and to earn national academic accolades. Amazing stories are being written every day at UAA. More at uaa.alaska.edu/admissions. This message sponsored by UAA.
Recently retired Ketchikan High School teacher and local pastor Doug Edwards has been arrested and charged with 3 counts of sexual abuse of a minor. According to the complaint filed in court by Police Detective Devin Miller, the charges stem from incidents last fall with a 14-year-old girl. She knew Edwards through his roles as a pastor with First Baptist Church and as a culinary arts teacher at Ketchikan High School. Police say Edwards has admitted to the crimes. Ketchikan Police Sergeant Andy Burnson says the investigation started in mid-April when the girl's father approached police to report that his daughter told him and her mother about the incidents.
These things do sometimes take some time, a lot of different investigative, you know, techniques you can use, because you certainly want to have as much information available before you present it to, you know, for prosecution and look at charges.
The girl also spoke to police, according to the complaint. In her statement, she provided details of multiple encounters. In each, Edwards allegedly reached into the girl's shirt, under her bra, and groped the girl's bare chest. One encounter allegedly happened in the basement of the church when she was alone playing the piano. Another allegedly happened at Edwards' home, where she had gone to watch a movie with another girl. A third encounter allegedly took place in the storage area of the high school's culinary arts room. According to the complaint, Edwards admitted to police that the encounters took place and that he had groped the girl. The police say Edwards also admitted doing the same thing to another young girl. Burnson says police are aware of the impact of these kinds of charges to everyone involved and are careful to make sure they are confident about the allegations.
I mean, in all cases, you want to be sure, but certainly there's a higher level of scrutiny on higher profile cases and higher level of crimes, which this is both, you know, and it's certainly going to have a big impact on the community, as well as suspect and victim.
In a news release late Monday, police say the investigation is continuing. Burnson says that's partially because of the other girl Edwards identified, along with any other information that might come forward as a result of the charges. Burnson says he can't say whether the school district was aware of the investigation before this week, but it isn't common for police to involve anyone else in an investigation like this one. Edwards had his first court hearing this morning in Ketchikan Superior Court. He was released on $10,000 bail with conditions that he surrender his passport and remain in his home except for court hearings and to meet with an attorney. Edwards also is not to have contact with girls under 16. His next hearing is scheduled for June 22nd. Women are harassed and fear for their safety much more than men when they work as fishery observers. That's according to a report that NOAA's Office of Law Enforcement Officials presented about sexual harassment of observers to a meeting of the North Pacific Fishery Management Council in Kodiak this past week. The report shared preliminary data from an ongoing survey, and although the sample size is small, the survey reveals stark differences between the experiences of female and male observers. Daisha Eaton with KMXT has more.
Jacqueline Smith, a special agent for the NOAA Office of Law Enforcement in Anchorage, presented the report about sexual harassment of fishery observers to a meeting of the North Pacific Fishery Management Council in Kodiak on Thursday, June 7th. She presented some of the data that was compiled through an anonymous survey sent out to observers deployed in Alaska in 2016 and 2017. About 400 observers are employed in Alaska in any given year.
There were 20 questions that were asked about either safety or harassment, and I phrased it in ways that didn't come up with conclusions. I didn't ask them if they were sexually harassed. Rather, I asked them if they ever received unwanted, unwelcome comments of a sexual nature, or I asked them if they ever feared for their physical safety.
North Pacific groundfish and halibut fisheries observers are expected to accurately record sampling data, write reports, make observations of violations, and report suspected violations. Observers make sure boats are following required regulations while they're at sea, so they live aboard fishing boats with their crews, and a strong rapport with the fishermen they work alongside can really help observers do their job. But for women working as observers, this isolated environment can lead to uncomfortable or dangerous situations, according to the Observer Program's annual report. And almost half of all observers in Alaska are women. The survey's goal was to narrow down what observers were experiencing while working, says Smith.
2016, and these are all the positive responses that we got. There was 19% of the females who responded were made to fear for their physical safety in 2016 and 14 in 2017. Offensive comments made regarding age, sex, sexual orientation, religion, or race, ethnicity, 43% and 10% in 2016, as opposed to 38% and 4% in 2017.
The fact that some observers feared for their safety is distressing, but Smith also pointed out that this kind of work environment doesn't allow women to do their jobs well.
There have been times where the observer's trying to do their sampling and a crew member might stand directly in front of them. Or there might be a bunch of things that are put onto the observer sampling station when the crew knows that the observer is about to conduct their sample that prevents them from accessing it. A lot of times it is a person actually standing in front of the observer preventing them from going where they need to go.
Smith presented the North Pacific Fishery Management Council with NOAA's survey at its recent meeting in Kodiak. The body acknowledged that male and female observers have very different experiences when out with crews and expressed support for more research into sexual harassment among observers. NOAA has seen a drop in reports of sexual harassment in 2017, a significant drop. There were 14 reports in 2016 and just 7 in 2017, which could indicate law enforcement and industry efforts to educate and prevent sexual harassment could be working. Smith acknowledged, though, that because victims can lose trust in the government, their employers, and law enforcement, they may not report experiences such as sexual harassment to authorities. One of the goals of the survey is to find out what the barriers are to reporting such incidents. 21 females and 31 males responded from the 2016 cohort, and 21 females and 26 males from the 2017 cohort. The results of the survey are preliminary, and NOAA Law Enforcement plans to continue conducting it for several more months. The final report is scheduled to be released during the December meeting of the North Pacific Fishery Management Council. In Kodiak, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska's legal marijuana industry wants the state to change the way it taxes pot. The Regulatory Marijuana Control Board plans to discuss tax and supply issues during a meeting tomorrow in Anchorage. Growers say the tax is squeezing their profit margins, and some complain that it keeps prices artificially high. It comes as other legal pot states have struggled with marijuana taxes. In California, licensed pot businesses are blaming combined state and local tax rates that can approach 50% for driving sales back into the black market. Some lawmakers are proposing a temporary tax cut. Washington state lawmakers, prompted by industry, scrapped a three-tier tax structure in 2015 and replaced it with a single excise tax at the point of sale. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, highlighting the joys of traditional foods.
I will tell you, you know, that when we were growing up and going to school, people would make fun of us because of our food, and, you know, we became ashamed of it.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education offers student and family education loans with interest rates lower than the federal plus, and they can be used at college and training programs in or outside of Alaska. Get more information at 800-441-2962 or visit acpe.alaska.gov/radio. This message sponsored by the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, Alaska's higher education state agency.
The Fairbanks City Council took a big step Monday toward taking over ownership of the old Polaris Hotel, a step that Mayor Jim Matherly hopes will lead to demolition of the contaminated and condemned downtown structure.
We have to legally own the property to do much with it.
Monday's 5-0 vote on an ordinance sponsored by Matherly and Councilman David Pruse enables the city to begin a process of acquiring ownership of the Polaris through foreclosure. The measure authorizes the city to pay $49,000 to the borough to cover property taxes that Anchorage developer Mark Marlowe, who owns the structure, has failed to pay since 2015. Matherly says passage of the ordinance enables the city to seek funding to help pay the $4 million demolition cost.
By putting it into our hands, it gives us a lot more power to obtain federal funds, to obtain state funds, any kinds of help that we can get to tear it down.
City officials say Marlowe hasn't responded to their concerns. He also didn't return phone calls for this story. The mayor says it'll take a while for the city to finally arrange a date for demolition. He says it'll likely take a while for the legal process to get to that point, mirroring the pace at which the city has had to proceed since it and the Downtown Association of Fairbanks began working in earnest on the project in 2015.
Have a wrecking ball date yet on the Polaris building. It has actually been baby steps, no doubt about it.
Matherly said during Monday's meeting, it's still possible Marlowe will pay the more than $50,000 he owes the borough for 2015's back taxes and retain ownership of the Polaris. Regardless, the mayor says the city will move quickly to secure the building to keep vandals from breaking into it. Fairbanks police have responded to nearly 100 complaints for break-ins and other such activity since 2009. Besides the nuisance, the vandals also risk exposure to such contaminants as asbestos and black mold that spread throughout the building after years of neglect.
We're going to secure that building in the next 30 to 60 days. People won't be breaking in all the time. We're going to secure it really well because that's just not your average empty building. It is beyond dilapidated inside with a whole lot of dangerous things in there.
Meanwhile, the Downtown Association of Fairbanks will continue raising the rest of the $135,000 the city needs to gain ownership of the building. The money will be used to buy the note from a lender who loaned Marlowe $130,000. Matherly says the organization already has raised about half that amount. The Homer City Council's regular meeting was canceled yesterday afternoon after three council members refused to attend over a mayoral proclamation. The proclamation celebrated the LGBTQ community in Homer and declared June as Homer Pride Month. Despite the pushback, a crowd of about 80 Homer residents gathered outside of Homer City Hall to hear Mayor Brian Zack read the declaration. Residents and other members of the council condemned the three local representatives' decision. The council members say they pulled out of the meeting not because they take issue with the gay community, but because they say the proclamation was divisive. KBBI's Renee Gross has more.
Mayor Brian Zack read the proclamation to a crowd of about 80 Homer residents outside of City Hall Monday evening. The City Council's regularly scheduled meeting was canceled after council members Heath Smith, Tom Struzas, and Shelley Erickson refused to attend because they said Mayor Zack's decision to declare June Homer Pride Month was divisive. But Zack said it was important to recognize the diverse LGBTQ population.
The city's employees, visitors, and business owners within the city of Homer who contribute to the enrichment of our city are a part of the lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, and gender community.
The proclamation drew both criticism and support on both sides of the political spectrum. City Clerk Melissa Jacobson says over 170 emails, both for and against the declaration, poured into the clerk's office Monday. Several of those emails were also addressed to council members and the mayor. Jacobson says roughly 65 were duplicates from Alaska Right to Life, an Anchorage-based pro-life group. A similar number came in supporting Zach's recognition, and roughly 45 emails opposed the move. The three council members who pulled out of the meeting say the proclamation contained remnants of a resolution from 2017 that was the basis for a divisive recall against three council members. Councilmember Smith says he didn't attend Monday's meeting to make a statement.
If we want to talk about true diversity, then we need to take into account the fact that we have a broad and deep base of people within our community that may not agree with that belief system.
Others on the council, like Rachel Lord, say groups outside of the community, like Alaska Right to Life, influenced the council members' decision. Lord added that she received several emails from groups in Anchorage, Fairbanks, and Juneau, among other places.
We are all representing Homer, and I don't want to speak to their personal beliefs or their personal feelings, but they were certainly influenced enough by outside folks and to not even come and to kind of sabotage the meeting to not happening, and I think that that's irresponsible at best.
Alaska Right to Life touted the three council members' decision on Facebook. Pat Martin is the head of outreach for the pro-life nonprofit. Martin says Ketchumak Bay Family Planning Clinic, which helped to organize Homer's upcoming Pride March later this month, is trying to benefit off the proclamation.
Greater support for Gay Pride Month means greater turnout, greater support for Ketchumak Bay Family Planning Clinic's fundraising event at the end of the Gay Pride Parade.
Alaska Right to Life also called the proclamation pro-abortion and anti-family because of its connection to the Family Planning Clinic.
I have no clue where they feel that there's a correlation between abortion and pride.
Catriona Reynolds is the executive director of Ketchumak Bay Family Planning Clinic. She says the organization offers a multitude of health services, including referrals to providers who provide abortion services. But Reynolds adds that the fundraiser is aimed at raising money for the clinic and its programming, and that it's not specifically related to its abortion referral services. Still, some council members who refused to attend Monday's meeting say they did take emails from outside of the community into account. Councilmember Struzis says he did factor comments from both inside and outside of the community into his decision to not attend the meeting.
And the reason for it was easy. If someone took the time to send an email, then that was in a negative tone, then obviously they were against the recognition.
The city has not rescheduled Monday's meeting. The city council is scheduled to meet again on June 25th. Reporting in Homer, I'm Renee Gross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing and exploring on the North Slope and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, unlocking Alaska's energy resources. And by Matson, committed to the communities it serves, building on more than 50 years of service to the communities of Alaska. Learn more at Matson.com.
There was something different about the food contest at this year's biennial event in Juneau, Celebration. Along with the usual samples of seaweed, judges also tasted seal oil, which was rendered in communities throughout Southeast. But the competition wasn't just about awarding the traditional food. The event organizer says it's also about a history of cultural resilience that still resonates today. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Elizabeth Jenkins has the story.
The judges call this tasting the breakfast of champions. And they aren't kidding. They're snacking on nutritious jars of seal oil at 10 in the morning. Jody Mitchell dips her spoon into a jar the color of amber.
So I see you're going back for another bite of that one.
Yeah, I like this one.
I do too.
Mm. Floating on top of this oil is crackling, or crispy seal fat. She says it melts in the mouth.
You know, my mom used to love these the best. I remember her picking them out of the jar and eating them, you know, so it reminds me of her. Yeah. She put seal oil on everything.
Mitchell is keeping track of the tastings with points and notes, which she'll share with the other judges later. Some seal oil is heavy, others are light. It's created by simmering the fat over a low to medium heat, a delicate process that can impact the flavor. For Mitchell, a winning entry tastes like being transported home.
Just taking a bite of this reminds me of my grandparents and sitting around the table eating native food. with all of them, and that was the best. I mean, food's always best when you share it.
And Sea Alaska Heritage President Rosita Worrell says that's the reason seal oil was added to the competition this year. She'd like to see more people proudly enjoying their traditional foods. Unfortunately, she says it hasn't always felt welcome, especially at a time when Native people were forced to assimilate.
I will tell you, you know, that when we were growing up and going to school, people would make fun of us because of our food, and, you know, we became ashamed of it.
But she says seal oil is something to be celebrated. She likes to eat it with dry fish or potatoes. But as a girl, just 6 years old, taken to a federal boarding school in Haines, seal oil was nowhere to be found. She says all the kids were homesick for the flavor, so they gravitated towards something the boarding school had plenty of that tasted similar.
They would serve cod liver oil, for it was like a vitamin, and we would love it. And we would kind of circle back and get in the line so that we could have more of it.
Although boarding schools are a thing of the past, Worrell thinks the policies that discourage Native people from harvesting traditional foods are not. To hunt seal, a person has to have a certain percent of Native blood, according to the Marine Mammal Protection Act. And it's becoming harder for the younger generations to meet that threshold. According to the Bureau of Indian Affairs, in the last decade, nearly 20,000 Alaska Native people had less than the federal requirement.
I went to a meeting and I heard a grandfather say, "I can't even take my grandson out to go hunting seal with me."
And Worrell says that means less seal, and seal oil is making it into people's homes for elders and future generations to enjoy. She'd like to see that change. In the meantime, she says including it in this year's food contest serves as a reminder. The taste for seal oil isn't going away.
So I think this is number one. You agree?
I can live with that.
You can live with that.
Back at the judges' table, after discussing the nuances of all the different jars, the judges decide who they'll award first place. One judge says it's the seal oil she'd be most likely to crack open and share with family and friends. The winning entries came from Angoon, Metlakatla, and Cake. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Jenkins in Juneau.
And maybe it's just my bias towards the chunks that are in there.
Former Alaska Attorney General Avram Gross died last month at the age of 82. He had pancreatic cancer. Republican Governor Jay Hammond appointed the East Coast Democrat in 1974 to be the state's top attorney. It was a seminal time for the Alaska Permanent Fund, and as KTOO's Jeremy Shea learned, Avram Gross had a key role.
Avram Gross was born in 1936 and grew up in New Jersey. As a child, Gross went to the Juilliard School to study violin. Here's Gross in a 1986 KTOO television interview.
I was driven so hard at it that when I finally left high school and went to college, I stopped playing the violin for 15 years. I just stopped. I never picked it up again. I couldn't stand it. All I could think of was getting up at 5 in the morning and practicing it, having my father yelling at me that I wasn't doing it right.
He earned his law degree at the University of Michigan, his father was a Columbia lawyer, and moved to the young state of Alaska in 1961.
It was sort of the idea of taking a couple of years off and for a lark. I decided, well, why not try Alaska? I always liked to fish. And I came up here, and after 2 years, I was hooked.
His oldest daughter, Jody Gross, remembers her father in the 1960s in Juneau as
this Jewish guy from New Jersey.
She says he was sympathetic to the hippie movement, talked civil rights in his family living room with local high school kids, and caused an uproar by delivering a politically provocative high school graduation speech. By 1974, Alaska had elected Hammond governor. The Republican described the blowback after he picked Gross for attorney general in this 2004 interview for 360 North.
A lot of folk cussed me out for appointing Av Gross. Oh, well, yeah, he's a brilliant attorney, but he's a Democrat. You know, long-haired, hippie-type Democrat from New York.
Hammond stuck with his pick, and Gross said he didn't have to sacrifice his principles to work with the governor.
The best advice you can give a governor, for instance, as attorney general, is the truth. If you tell the governor what the law really is, you keep him out of trouble. If you fudge the law because you think you're going to help the governor or give him some political, you know, advantage on a day-to-day basis or something, in the end, he inevitably gets into incredible trouble, and you're responsible for it.
For example, Gross recalled convincing Hammond to veto a bill the legislature passed to establish the Alaska Permanent Fund.
And Hammond had fought for the Permanent Fund all his life. He really felt strongly about it. And I called him up and told him that the bill was unconstitutional.
Creating the permanent fund meant creating a dedicated fund, which can only be done through a constitutional amendment.
I mean, he was so upset. I mean, he said to me, you know, I want to sign this bill. I so much want to sign this bill. Can't you find some way? You know, and I said to him, no, I can't find some way. It is unconstitutional. You have an obligation as a governor to veto this bill. But he did. He reluctantly, very reluctantly, vetoed the permanent fund bill.
That was 1975. Then Hammond introduced a constitutional amendment that lawmakers and the people did pass the following year to lawfully establish the permanent fund. Gross said Hammond was better for it. Gross covered a lot of other legal ground in his public career, including banning state prosecutors from plea bargaining in a policy experiment still studied decades later, defending the division of elections in a contested gubernatorial primary recount, and defending the initial permanent fund dividend program, which rewarded longer residency in Alaska with bigger dividends, but was eventually struck down by the U.S. Supreme Court. Gross left the Attorney General's office in 1980 and returned to private practice in Juneau. He also got back into music after his brother reintroduced him to his violin through fiddle music.
I dusted it off and I opened it up and I started to play. I loved the music and it was sufficiently different than the classical music that I'd been raised on that I didn't hear, you know, my father over my shoulder with all the bad vibrations that caused. So I could enjoy my talent and enjoy my training so long as I was playing a different kind of music. It's given me an immense amount of joy.
He played in a band called the Grateful Dads, local festivals, and the Southeast Alaska State Fair's fiddle contest. Gross also bought a historic cannery across Chatham Strait from Angoon. Jody Gross says he used it as a second home, family retreat, and fishing hole.
And that's where he wanted to die.
Her father was diagnosed with pancreatic cancer about 16 months ago and declined treatment.
Some of his last words were in response to something I said. He said, "No, Jody, the most important thing is to always keep your fishing rod tip up," because that's really how he thought. He was in his element when he was fishing.
He died at the cannery on May 8th in the company of close family members. Alaska flags flew at half-staff form a few days last month. No other public memorials are planned. In Juneau, I'm Jeremy Shea.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org/news. You can also find us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media. We had reports tonight from Layla Carey in Ketchikan, Daisha Eaton in Kodiak, Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, Elizabeth Jenkins and Jeremy Shea in Juneau, and Renee Gross in Homer. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. Raven, Alaska. Raven serves Alaskans in over 115 communities across the state. Seasonal summer routes now available to Cordova, Anchorage, and Valdez. Information available at flyraven.com. First National Bank Alaska, offering online and mobile services to help Alaskans and their businesses bank on the go. Learn how experience and knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. And by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting.
If you're looking for business opportunities in the government marketplace, you'll want to know about the Alaska Procurement Technical Assistance Center. Alaska PTAC helps businesses navigate the challenging process of the federal, state, and local government procurement cycles with offices in Anchorage and Fairbanks and delivers services statewide. More information at ptacalaska.org. This message sponsored by Alaska PTAC.
This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.